everyone, it's Taking Stock. It's October 9th, and I'm joined by John Wooten. And today we're looking forward to talk about decentralized management, teamwork, and growth. Essentially, how can we incorporate as many different ideas as possible from as many different people as possible in a way that is as transparent as possible without having a bunch of top-down, not necessarily authoritarian, but, how can we achieve decentralized leadership with all the tools that we have at our disposal, and what are our goals to do so? We're implementing some fun stuff down the line. I'm really looking forward to speaking with John in a bit more detail about all that. And thanks for joining us. How are you doing today, John?
Hey, Chives, doing stellar. And so I've got some news on the decentralization front that I just learned about looking at X, which I think is something that is of material relevance to this conversation. And so I will announce that news in the middle of this episode. But before I do, I want to set the stage with what we just went through for approximately 20 minutes trying to set this episode up, alongside some remarks that were made in the early episode, which actually only exists because, as we were saying in the last session that was terminated, for context, this is our third attempt at making this this group, this space, this chatting area, and this forum has been shut down for reasons we don't know twice before when we were hosting it, as we discussed on the episode with Kerr, on the YDRS X account. In the idea there is that we can have it in one place. There was a whole discussion about that, and it's a pretty common practice to do it on the DAO account as the host, and then people come up and speak, and it's easier to see everything in one place, and it gives you a way to have this historic record without using a community or any other kind of group or any other logging chat. And instead, you can sort of just do it in a way that fosters that teamwork. It allows everyone to go towards that common goal. And instead of having a rotation of accounts host the show, and following a point person, which Chives has tremendous, I mean, you've done a stellar job, Chives, and continue to do a stellar job. I think I've said this many times with what you do at the show, having it on the same time, having it consistent, having it as this focal point for the community. So key, so crucial, and such an aligning factor, and that lets the more passionate members, or the ones that want to have their voices heard, really come up without permission. I forget if I mentioned it on here, if I put it in chat. I do believe I put it in chat on Discord, and so I'll tell the story of the first interaction we had on the Origins of DTC episode, which is at wooten.link/origins. In that episode, I had never really used this platform seriously before. There was one time in high school where our English teacher made us create back when it was Twitter, she made us create an account, and we were forced to like tweet some homework assignments. And I thought it was like the silliest thing ever. And I was always so infuriated by the lack of how much you could write. You could only write 140 characters back then. And it was like two sentences, and I'm not the kind of guy that's particularly skilled at shortening things down to two sentences, as I think we can sort of clearly see by the many, 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 many hour plus logged videos on YouTube describing at some points in time one concept and just going on and on. Because as I said so many times, I do prefer comprehensiveness, at least in primary source material that's not built for entertainment instead of truncating things. Yeah. I saw a clip recently. It was every single thing we teach at Y Combinator in 5 minutes. And, frankly, that's just, it's misleading at best, because, and it's not that it's not in good faith. Of course it's in good faith, but it's part of this algorithm. It's part of this centralization, and it's part of this control system that's come to overtake effectively the entirety of the web. I remember when I was growing up, an artist that I loved as a kid posted a lot of content on Tumblr. And in 2018, Tumblr, as a centralized social media website, decided that they were going to ban them from the platform, delete their whole history. I mean, And this artist's entire career, just to frame it, was built on Tumblr. Every single thing they've done, their commissions, which is how they make money, right? They give this art away for free and then people can pay them to do like specific drawings or such, right? Everything about this person's life existed on this Tumblr page for that person. And when Tumblr revoked their access to the platform, destroyed literally years of work, and crushed an artist's ambitions with the click of a button, with the change of a policy, with the stroke of an executive, and ruined the chances of self-sovereignty, economic independence, and truly passionate work that this individual and thousands like them had on that platform at that time before this action. Well, I just see that and I ask why. Why does it need to be like this? And what do you think, Chives? Do you think it has to do with the fact that effectively all social media companies today are public for-profit corporations?
Well, certainly I do, John. I'm sorry to hear about that person's situation, but it's not uncommon whatsoever. A lot of individuals, not only in 2018 and in years before, but much more today, rely on these online platforms, which are predominantly centralized and for profit, to facilitate outreach to communities that they've developed and in many cases, in some way, monetize their connection to those communities. Which, you know, is not necessarily some nefarious thing. As you pointed out, there are many who want to willingly support the creators and community developers who they, you know, who they engage with on a repeated basis, who bring joy or meaning into the way that they engage online. And so these communities are absolutely operating entirely at the beck and call of these gigantic monopolistic for-profit entities. I don't think this is, you know, a conversation that would be alien to most people who use the internet today, even if they're not directly impacted as a creator or as a fan of a creator who has entered arrears or, you know, got into the wrong side of any of these monopolistic corporations. I think it's unfortunately something that's kind of been accepted in the Web 2 environment. And certainly, and I think I appreciate you bringing all this up. I think it is related not only to what we experienced just in the last 20 minutes, but broadly, you know, our goals in terms of community development and transparency in the future. But, you know, this is something that I think a lot of people are aware of, but maybe, you know, they don't think about it day to day because there's no clear alternative available. And it doesn't really seem as though regulators see any kind of problem with how these sorts of systems have panned out and developed in this capitalist internet that we have.
I'm with you there, Chives. And on the note of the developing early alternatives, I think I'll circle it back. As you can see, if you're live here, just a few days ago, I begrudgingly forked over the $90 to get a blue circle next to my name. And it was entirely, and firstly, I haven't done this for quite some time because it was mostly just regulatory arguments and technical developments for the past 4 years. And so there was never really any need to, you know, get the voice out there, or so to speak. And I never, like, I thought about, like, advertising, and I, like, went through the steps to do advertising for 9 to Noon and for the finance education and even just my YouTube channel. But, you know, it's like, what I realized is that if you go down that path, you basically have to sell things. And I just really didn't feel like that was the way to do quality decentralized financial education. And or even just quality financial education, period. I think it makes absolutely zero goddamn sense that in order to learn how to invest well, some people tell you that you need to invest thousands of dollars with them in a proprietary educational course. I appreciate that that is a way to turn your online presence and very material amount of work. I mean, I invested thousands of hours, thousands of dollars in freelance work, and a lot of passion that could have gone towards other things into making at least 6 courses, full-fledged. Like, these are courses on my YouTube channel. And for the longest time, it was like, how do you pay for this? And for me, I just paid it out of my trading profits, and I inserted in a, throughout a lot of that content, there are like these affiliate things. And affiliate marketing is very interesting in the sense that it's the only real permissionless way to sell things without, like, as a sponsorship, as a brand deal, so to speak. And it's the same model, it's the same challenge that we have with these central social media companies, where the barrier to sign up is extremely low, but at any point in time, like when Musk bought X, they stole, you know, they commandeered the X username from the person that had had it for 20 years, or 15 years, whatever. And that is exactly the scenario that this affiliate thing is, whereby you can sign up and get things going, but you know, you're at the whim. And I've seen firsthand accounts deleted, programs ended, things that I have referenced in this educational content ceased from existence, or the terms and conditions materially changed after it was created by a central group of actors. And when I say materially changed, I mean the money goes from being in my pocket to a larger chunk being in the central actor's pocket. And that only happens because the power is not in the hands of the participants, the users, the people at the core of these efforts. And so recently I changed all of the affiliate marketing links in all of my courses to not go to affiliate marketing links. And you can see that change on GitHub on my link redirect site. And I say this because I understand that, you know, a lot of these people are really trying their best. A lot of them grew up in this era where the only way to learn things, to communicate, or to build a movement was to do so standing on a podium, attending a conference, or at the highest end of the scale, face to face. But that is not our present reality. That is not the vision of the internet. And that is not how you enable egalitarian, permissionless innovation. When I talk about permissionless innovation, Chives, about a month ago, everyone knows f.limo is sort of this thing where you can redirect an IPFS site, you know, and I don't really want to dive into the exact specifics of these particular things today, but I'll just do it as like a high level topic, because I know some people are familiar and some people, this is just going to go way over your head, and I'm sorry, but I just want to talk about principles here. So I bought the domain xlm.limo some time back, and then I reached out to the creator of the person that's making Sorbonne domains, you know, the domain system on Stellar, so to speak, and, you know, told them, hey, I want to work on this. And they like never replied, because who gives a shit, right? Like, you know, you don't need permission to do work. You don't need permission to build your own website. You can make it open source. You can keep it internal. I don't care. I think it matters. I think there's implications to that. We can circle back. But when you put it on IPFS, when you upload the code and you get the hash for it, and that becomes a website that anybody can host at any time on any computer, well, now you don't have the monolithic centralized entities controlling every aspect of it. You don't have the select group of individuals dictating the policies. And indeed, you don't have the corruption or the avenue for corruption so endearingly present in every one of these central intermediaries that gives them the power at their whim to shift the terms, to change the bargain, to modify the deal, largely to serve the interest of their shareholders. This morning, someone by the name of Overcat, who is a longstanding developer in the Stellar ecosystem, built some just tremendous software over the years, and in every sense of the word, you know, personifies this idea of permissionless innovation. They have their profile picture on every social is a cat. Their username is Overcat. It's anonymous. It's pseudonymous, right? And the vast majority of the development, it just happens in open source. They publish it for free. They write great documentation. I've never met this person in my life. I sent them one message on X like a month ago. I said, enable sponsors on your GitHub account. And then they replied like 2 days ago. And that's it. Okay. I don't even think I've like talk to this guy, this person on Discord. I swear I've just used their Python, a lot of the things that they work on, that they built, that they created. And that's the key here, is that the creator economy is not just for these big name social media influencers. We're sitting in a space right now with three people. It's about anyone. I mean, our Discord is on the high end, 2,000, we're dealing with systems that, for the first time in history, can develop without a centralization of capital, can develop without one single sphere of influence, it can develop without asking a select few investors, a select few regulators, a select few clients how they want something done. You can really just go out and do it. And that is the exact principle that in the first episode of Decentralizing Capitalism, I talk a lot about some of my history and specifically how I grew up seeing the 1%, but not really being in the 1%. And that particular mentor who was so key to my growth, I asked them recently, if they ever asked permission to start their business, if the founders ever needed to go and convince people that what they were doing was a good idea, that what they were doing being something that sold for hundreds of millions of dollars after decades of work. And of course the answer is no, because the invisible hand dictates the terms of the deal. It establishes the foundations of the system and it aligns everyone with the objective to accumulate capital. And unfortunately, there's a very small select few people that have done that extraordinarily well and created these enormous gates, these insurmountable obstacles, these mammoth barriers for anyone to really copy them. I'll give you the example on the investing front. You can't open a goddamn broker. You can't open a clearing agency. You can't open an ATS without a lot of money, a lot of interest. I mean, that's probably the lowest bar out of everything that's regulated on the trading front. If we just let these intermediaries stand as the core tenants of our society and do nothing to question their resolute power, monopolistic business practices, and ongoing dedication to suppressing competition, where does that leave us in 10 years? Where does it leave us when Google can pay the browsers to use Google to force their users into the system? Where does that leave us when corporations can pay their employees to not work at other companies, can inscribe in their fundamental contracts the disability to compete? Where does that leave us when one company holds every goddamn stock in America? We see how dictatorships work out. Well, what's that leave us when it comes to corporate dictatorships? And there might be this ambivalence of a board, but who is really in control of these systems? What do you think on that, Chives?
Well, I think it's hard to sum. I think you've done as good a job as possible over the last few minutes, but it's hard to sum the extent of this problem. To speak to what you had brought up most recently, right? The idea of governance and who is making decisions and how are those decisions audited and viewed by the stakeholders that might, be directly influenced by what is served at the table, but perhaps don't have a seat there themselves. That varies quite a lot. And there's certainly not as much disclosure and transparency as I would like in this traditional, I guess we'll say consolidated power ecosystem. And I think it goes beyond, when thinking about communication on the internet, I was glad when you brought up IPFS earlier, the idea of this decentralized web hosting, yeah, a lot of folks may realize how powerful single entities like Twitter and Meta, through their various platforms, and Google and Amazon, how monolithic these companies are. But what's even more consolidated than that is the web hosting underneath. You know, between Cloudflare, Google, Amazon, you're talking about a handful of companies that control half or more of the web hosting. And I mean, who's to say how much that influences, you know, how much do their policies and preferences influence how their clients operate online? And those clients, of course, as you pointed out, their policies and preferences have direct influence over how all of the rest of us operate online. And there is the potential for an incredible, diverse, mutually beneficial creator economy lurking just under the surface here. One that we see inklings of all over the internet, I think, and it's growing, maybe not rapidly, but certainly growing, where you have individuals that are developing content or providing a service, not selling a service, that's different, right? But providing a service or developing a community, being supported by that community through some kind of, you know, whether or not it's a simple token incentive, like you see on YouTube, people reading off the names of their supporters, or something even less tangible, where it's simply a donation of appreciation, like your example with the creator whose icon is a cat. You know, I think that's a beautiful thing, and it'd be wonderful to embrace the transition to that kind of economy. I think the trouble is that all these monoliths that you and I have just been describing stand squarely in the way of that. So there's a careful route to tread to ensure that we can spread information, spread access to the tools that enable this kind of support, while also being cognizant of the idea that it's traveling upstream, because the entire ecosystem of the internet, as developed pretty much since the dot-com boom, is asynchronous to that.
With you there, Chive. The governance front, it really seems to be at least the most frightening. I don't know if that's the right word for it, but it's definitely something that I could talk all day about per the episode on the OCC comment. In recent news, there was, of course, that recent action with an investor group suing the SEC. And you know, I haven't looked at the exact specifics, so I don't care to comment extensively yet. But, you know, for me, a lot of the question is, you know, like, why is this happening? Why are people ongoingly suing the SEC? Well, you know, why aren't they letting the regulator do their jobs and instead dragging them into court? And we have, you know, Chair Gensler on the interview on Apple TV saying hand in fist that the commission, the SEC, the agency needs to be willing to go to court and litigate these things. And indeed they do go to court and approve these landmark cases. You know, it seems like, so much time, effort and resources, that could be really put, you know, to better use to making the market more efficient. And the SEC gets no money. And to think that the limited options they have for what to do largely get consumed by a judicial system that is respectfully not as transparent as it could be. They're trying their best. Like Pacer is a good step forward, but the interfaces could be better. And even I still reach out to law firms to get a lot of material that isn't super easy to access through the public disclosure system presently in place. You know, that's not right. And it certainly stifles innovation. And parallel I'll give to this example with Overcat is that today they announced that they made XLM.sh, which is, you know, same thing, a gateway for IPFS. They made this interface with the Web2 browsers that they let you see this information without any permissions, without any setups. And it just gives you instantly access to publishing anything you want in a GitHub repo and putting on IPFS, which can, I guess, host. I mean, that's what the database is on for YDRS. And now, bam, it's available to anyone, and you have that real domain to reference, to cite, to share in a way that is compatible with these present systems. These present systems, I understand, like I said, that they came from good intentions, and on the topic of X is this place where this news comes out, and it seems to be the source that everyone so fervently supports. I support Musk and what they're doing, and holistically, at least you can see sort of the context there at wooten.link/aspirations. And that was something I wrote when I was very young, and I appreciate that he's a smart guy, but I think the question becomes, even if you have the smartest person in the world, say, you've got the best president you could ever elect. They are just an absolute genius in every sense of the word. They have 100% approval rate, and every single person votes for them. You know, should we really give in the early, early, early days of our great nation, when there were a group of people recovering from did it make sense to have a select few people lead it? Sure, it did. I read a book by the Alexander Hamilton Institute from the 1920s about, how to run a business. And all it was centralizing tasks. It was, organizing people into units and putting those units and divisions underneath managers and giving those managers metrics and how to do everything you would expect in a traditional organization structure. And that works just fine for these incumbent world, but it doesn't seem to work very well for public utilities. It doesn't seem to work very well for infrastructure so key to capitalism itself. And it doesn't seem to work so well for the financial system. And I think that if we can extrapolate those sentiments towards something so key to human creativity, recently we've had on here multiple times, and in the community and around the area, Chives, can you help me? It's Dollar Endgame.
Oh, that's Peruvian Bell.
Yes, of course, PB. Names, just, I got to see it on my screen sometimes. So sorry about that. I quoted one of his articles, and I've been using his articles in my regulatory arguments. And they're tremendous. He's phenomenal. Really, seriously, tremendous work. He goes in with absolutely stellar details. He's actually hiring team members to go through freaking Bloomberg terminal data. I mean, I can't think of a better example of someone that started from nothing. That person I hired to do my YouTube videos, literally, they were just a creator on YouTube. They started editing my stuff, and they started hiring people in Brazil to work for them. I think by the time I stopped doing the videos, they were at like four employees, just editing, and that's what happens when you give people not just the economic ability to become their own enterprises, not just the belief that they can do it themselves, and not just the education requisite to long-standing success, but when you give them a means of operating that isn't subject to a select few people. I was this guy's only client by my understanding. And when I stopped working because I just didn't have the bandwidth anymore and it was emotionally draining to do all this content, well, I don't know what happened with him. I haven't really reached out with him since. And frankly, the most I have to get to him is an old WhatsApp number. And that's the kind of thing, just for some more context on that, we found each other through an online freelance matching platform that was by itself centralized, but we started just working individually between each other on a decentralized basis. I started paying the guy through Coinbase. And that is something that is, I see so much power in, because you eliminate these intermediaries, you eliminate these middlemen, you eliminate these rent extractors in a way that just hasn't existed before. And something that I couldn't believe, this is by my understanding, one person. By my understanding, also, Nakamoto was one person. It was Sasamon. And this is like, you know, these individuals, they just go and they find something that they want to work on, and they just do it because of that invisible hand, because of some internal forces, because they see the world not for what it is, but for what it should be. And I just don't think that that is adequately rewarded in our present financial system. And it's certainly not at, and so back to the station of publishing, it's certainly not something that, I fear so ungodly, so much that PBN, these thousands of, there are some great writers on the platform that they use, will face in 25 years the exact same impediment that every single one of these platforms goes down. People start complaining about the YouTube algorithm 10 years after it's created because now they've locked you in. People start complaining about the Facebook algorithm 10 years after it's happened because now they have you locked in, and maybe it even decreases. And particularly on the back, circling back to the sphere of public influence, I've seen firsthand the advertising costs on every single one of these social media platforms very logarithmically increase. And there are indeed recent unveilings in court filings that show employees at Google saying they're going to make the numbers for the quarters by juicing up the ad rates. And nobody has any control over that. They just get to do it because there isn't really an alternative. There isn't really competition. And there certainly isn't really an efficient system that could become that parallel, that could become that new piece, and that could become that system so key to our innovations. Recently, Bob posted a meme in the memes channel where it was, you know, and Bob is someone that has been working tirelessly for our purpose, has been working nonstop to further this cause, and has been working extensively to popularize some very niche, nuanced and intricate content so key to the principles surrounding DRS with virtually no consideration whatsoever. He's not even part of the smaller group of activists. And to think that he, of all people, who is someone that really has just been putting in so much effort over the years, is literally scraping by. This meme shows and depicts, and if someone could put it in the nest, that would actually be super helpful. I would really appreciate that. When I see it, it makes me think that, and through the conversations that we've had both publicly and on the Discord in a voice channel that's not recorded, you know, it's like someone that's just, in every respect and in every sense of the word, because I'm in the exact same situation. It's someone that's just getting by and barely making it. And you know, recently my partner's mom went through some personal developments, and in accordance with that, I am now helping her manage her retirement, so to speak. It's something, you know, everyone, If I really care about someone and they really trust me, which has happened before in the family, obviously, with the early fund, you know, everyone I know, they want me to manage their money, and most people I won't do it. But for this instance, for these circumstances, I said, okay, sure, I'll help you out, and just throw it in long term stuff. You know, who cares, right? I don't trade anymore, at least not right now. God, all I want to do is go back to trading. That's where I can be most creative, but that's a whole nother story. Anyway, So start working on that. And God, what was
it? Take a breather.
What was I on before that? Because I feel like it's relevant. I just don't remember why.
Well, I think broadly you were speaking about
kind of, yes, just getting individual by. So she's living paycheck to paycheck, and she's in her 50s.
Mm-hmm.
With it's all the respect, in every sense of the world. I mean, great person, tremendous career, has a college education, came to this country from nothing, learned English came to this country in the last year of high school, learned English in a year, graduated top of her class in English in college. Just an exceptional individual in every sense of the word. and has had this nonstop pursuit of a career helping in the healthcare space. A career that was voluntarily ended because the compensation received in healthcare was not enough to, she makes more in a career that requires no degree, and I'll leave it at that, than she did working in a hospital.
Yeah, that is unfortunately a common story. You know, my day job is in the healthcare sector, and I have known dozens of individuals that fit that same kind of description. Incredible people all, but unfortunately the churn of that particular industry in America is just suited towards something other than positive health results or empowering the workforce, you know, and we can leave it at that since it's a bit far afield from some of the other conversations that we've been going on. But I think ultimately, right, it speaks to the same broader problem that there are monopolies everywhere, which have their own motivations. And although many millions are influenced every day by the decisions of these gigantic entities, they've got very little ability to not only contribute their voice to the decision-making process, but to seek out viable alternatives. It's tricky, absolutely, but I think there's light at the end of the tunnel in the sense that we have access today to tools where we can visualize how alternative systems could work, not necessarily ones that are completely built from the top down, you know, that are organized in the same way, like neat and tidy Web 2 interfaces, but something where there's a bit more individuality to it, a bit more peer-to-peer engagement to it. And I think that's the maybe a good transition point towards trying to talk a bit more about how we want to build and engage with our community so that we can really step forwards towards this imagined future where we have a lot more cohesion between what the community wants and what the community is able to do.
I'm with you there, Chives, and I certainly agree that we have a lot of very smart community members with a lot of stellar ideas that are tirelessly pursuing that vision of a stock market that actually works. I'll put the image in the chat because I want to extend the discussion based off this. Do we know if Bob has an X to tag?
Yes, he does. Not only that, yes, he does. He's a listing right now. I guess. Say that. Yeah.
I can't see it. I don't see what. All right. Well, if someone wants to handle him or if he wants to comment it, but I'm just going to post it without I'll just post it without the username with it. Because I think this is really key to the story here. So we start with, you know, him. It's sort of this position that we're all in that you really, it is extremely challenging to have influence if you don't have equity at the table, if you don't have any kind, whether that's political equity, whether it's social equity, or whether it's hard cash equity. And the mammoth challenge is that a lot of the way capital gets distributed, it really isn't in the hands of the people like you and me that are really most affected by these systems. And along that sentiment, it becomes challenging to acquire the assets requisite to governance influence in a shareholder-based system. And so because of that, it is so challenging for the little guy to really change the policies of some of these, you know, these central institutions and to bring forth the effects that would be demonstrably better for everyone. And I think that is something wholeheartedly solved by the open source ethos. This idea that was so eloquently displayed by Overcat today, that you can literally do anything you want. You can add anything that you want to the repository of what's available. You can open up an item and say that it needs to get worked on. You can do any kind of change that you want and explain to people why, demonstrably, it is the better way to go. It is the more efficient path. It is the goal-oriented ideal scenario. And by the fact of merit alone, that argument can find its place in a real-life system. You can go in today. Anyone can go in today and make upgrades to Bitcoin. Anyone can go in today and make upgrades to Linux, which runs effectively almost like the vast majority of computers on the planet. Anyone can go in today and create their own change using these platforms and specifically on the organization of this show and really giving that voice to some that might traditionally be a little bit more disenfranchised, be a little bit more out of the sphere of influence, and specifically stand without an opportunity to invoke that change, because they, it's a real burden. It's not a burden, but it is a commitment to come on and stand up, to give the speeches, to go through the process, to keep politicking. And so what I've done just now is created a folder in the DAO Docs repo on GitHub, where I know someone that is a very longstanding community member in the Stellar ecosystem. Thank you. Oh, you sent it to me. I appreciate it. I'll change it. And they are soliciting questions for this upcoming, they're having a, a conference, a convention and such. And, the ones there will be the chief leaders of this community that have the most nuanced understanding of the technology, its mission, and the implications and motivation of what I think is truly going, is the financial system for the future. And so now anybody can go into the DAO Docs repo and make any change they want to get up. Just press the edit button. And if you have a question about the crypto ecosystem, if you have a question about Stellar in particular, sort of the audience here, but the harder questions you have for these individuals, the better it is what I've been told by Jerome. And an opportunity now to have a voice at the click of a button, to type a few words and have that materialize into true action. That's the exact same concept I've put into place in creating the Taking Stock repo and the YDRS work, where we can have these conversations without having to come up to the bar, or even if you just have a small little suggestion, you don't have to come on here and tell it to everyone. You can just put it in an issue, put it in a PR that you want to make some changes, or even just start a discussion, like the discussions that we're having so easily in a text-based environment where the commitment is really not as high for being part of that innovation. And you can see firsthand what it looks like for something that you contemplate, forge into materialization, and turn into something that people can understand. Well, now you can see that firsthand get incorporated into real production. You can see it on the DAO website. You can see it in the discussion on Taking Stock. And you can see it, if you got a great question, on a recording at a conference by someone thousands of miles away. And that's the opportunity that I see here. Let me know what you think, Chais. We can really invoke the change that's yearning deep inside each and every one of us through these permissionless systems where anyone at any time, without the authority, the authorization, or even the knowledge of us, of anyone, can make changes. I was doing a work item through a PR, and just a random community member yesterday, as I shared in the Discord, came in and did a ton of collaboration on it. Super helpful. Name is Silence. That's something that is not possible when we gatekeep the functionalities, the underlying infrastructure, and most key elements of capitalism behind the proprietary shrouding, the systemic bureaucracies, and the corruptible powers to be at a few select financial intermediaries. There are, what do you think on that, Jive?
Well, broadly speaking, I think you're dead on. You know, we're looking at a massive technologically driven and empowered transition towards encouraging as much collaboration as possible between people that are collectively self-interested to achieve some specific task. And I don't think that, I don't know that we speak so broadly as to say that, you know, every system would benefit from this kind of organization, because that's hard to say. But I think what we can easily say and would be hard to argue is that if communities are interested in this kind of system, then they should embrace it. And it's reasonable to do so with the tools that we have today. You know, as you mentioned, something like GitHub, a itself a practically open source platform for open source platforms and for community collaboration and development. You know, anyone can hop on without much barrier to entry and share their perspective or share their idea and allow that perspective or idea to flesh itself out and to be heard in a common space, because it should not matter, right? Not only who is positing the concept, but it also should not matter what the, like, let's say there is like this established, you know, these established leader bases, these centralized decision makers, you know, in this kind of system, even if they felt it was not a good idea, you know, if a vast majority of user base and contributors and maintainers of this, you know, a hypothetical, whatever it is, you know, if they think, oh, well, this actually does seem really helpful, does seem really useful, then it's something that can be incorporated and something that can be pushed forward, and everyone can grow and prosper thanks to the collective input of each other person. And I think that right there is why, essentially, why I think education, or rather perhaps an encouragement and commitment to curiosity, is so crucial for anyone who's trying to get involved or maybe even just curious about being involved, because you need to have that self-driven motivation to actually take the plunge. And yeah, the barrier to entry can be made as low as possible, can be made to be anonymous, can be made about the idea as much as feasible through this technology. But ultimately, I think that we need to encourage individuals to, you know, develop a sense of self-confidence, of familiarity with what they want and how they can fit into the greater whole. And that's where we're going to really benefit. You know, I know you brought up Bob before, an incredible community member, someone I've loved to get to know over the last year or two. And this is someone who, by his own admission, you know, has learned a lot just in these last, this last couple of months, couple of years. But as you said, is pushing forward such massive initiatives thanks to the boundless curiosity. And it's an inspiration to me to keep being curious, to keep learning, to keep better understanding what kind of arguments are going to be beneficial to people, and being open to when I don't know or when I'm misled or when I have the wrong understanding. And I think that is what a community collaboration is all about. These tools are what enable it. And that's why we need to focus so much, I think, on using these tools, utilizing this reality, because with the incumbent power structure here, as far as how things are organized, as far as how decisions are typically made, is wholly and completely different, as you've touched on eloquently over the last bits of this conversation. So I'm excited. You know, even right now, we're continuing to develop these tools, continuing to embrace a transition to a more transparent and community-focused development cycle. And I love having those values in place. I believe that we'll see, you know, more and more over time, people continuing to contribute, and that effort is going to grow on that side. And then maybe we can eventually, right, move away from the centralization that still exists in the framework. Places like the Discord server, using X for Twitter spaces, The web hosting itself that we currently use for YDRS are all examples of centralization that are still present and today necessary to facilitate community growth. But there will come a time where we can move past these things, I think, or at least, you know, keep them going, but have decentralized alternatives at the ready, like we have the Lemmy on the back end, for example. You know, as we grow as a community, the robust resilience of these alternative tools and platforms that are themselves more community focused, you know, they'll only become stronger, more resilient, positive feedback loop. That's how I see it going down.
Oh, with you there, Chives. And on that note, yeah, let's talk about the Lemmy, because I think this is really such a key part of the story in the context of the entire subreddit that was banned. Can you give us, I know there was a whole history episode, but can you give us just a little bit of history, just on the background specifically on that particular Reddit instance?
Sure. So briefly, people may be aware that our team had a subreddit that at its peak, I think was somewhere between 20,000 and 25,000 users. I'm not exactly sure. But it had been removed from Reddit, without warning, I guess about almost a year and a half ago now. There had been some communication back and forth with Reddit admin about some of the conduct on that subreddit in the months previous to it being taken down. And so we had kind of been aware, and maybe we need to be thinking about alternatives, just in case, because we wanted to stick to principles that, you know, we felt were within Reddit's guidelines, trying to respect their sovereignty as a private platform. This is, of course, before their IPO. And in any case, Lemmy was something that we decided on. For those unfamiliar, Lemmy is a decentralized open source social media platform, which has a UI and UX very similar to Reddit. The main differentiating factor here is that it's part of something called the Fediverse. Listen to that episode for more detail. I think actually we have a separate episode all about that as well. But long story short, kind of like the IPFS, decentralized internet hosting, anyone can host their, you know, communities, they're called, but, you know, interconnected subreddits, anyone can host any community and create a decentralized framework with connective tissue, because accounts on one instance can then go and comment on others. So we have been hosting our Lemmy instance again for about a year and a half, or a little bit less than that. That's something that, you know, some community members have been maintaining out of pocket. You know, we do not and have not ever accepted public donation to support any of our items at this time. You know, maybe down the line once the 501(c)(3) stuff is done. Now, as far as that Lemmy instance goes, anyone can go on there. Anyone can engage with it, make an account, communicate with individuals on that platform. However, we have unfortunately had a hard time keeping it stable. So it's become less of a focus for the community, I think, on the day to day. Discord is probably the most active place amongst our, you know, approved channels, as it were. The Lemmy is, you know, again, an open source project, but it's been difficult, for our team because although it's open source, it does have like a core development team. And it seems that the issues that we're having, just are not perhaps, they're not yet been solved by the Lemmy team, and we don't have the resources to contribute to their cause, unfortunately, this time. So anyone listening, if you are interested in taking a look at that, certainly, again, it's an open source project, so maybe one day it will be solved. Just right now, it's not yet. But that's the thing about these open source projects, John, that I really do love, is that sure, it may not be perfect right at this moment, whether that's for, you know, stability reasons, consistency reasons, or otherwise. But all that being said, it can only improve with time. This is a protocol that, since it's open source, even if it was abandoned by a core team, It could then be picked up by another individual or another team. And if this particular software were to improve in the future, then it would forever be improved. And I think the same of generally any open source project. I think of them as collective achievements that will continue to exist, you know, for collective benefit. And that's very exciting to me. And I look forward to, you know, our contributions to that, you know, broader ocean of effort.
Oh, love the sentiments there, Chive, and completely with you on it just always getting better. And I want to dive deep because I think this is a really important nuance that isn't really wholly understood, at least popularly. This idea that if something goes wrong or if our community disagrees with their community on a particular item, at any point in time, you can just click that fork button on GitHub and you can just start your own thing. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of forks of Bitcoin on GitHub. And we spoke with Pasta, who's the, you know, head honcho of the development corporation that is behind the furtherance of effectively there's Litecoin and there's Dash, and those are the ones that people know. And those are code forks. You just press that button on GitHub and you have a universe of opportunities. Those are projects worth billions of dollars because somebody decided that they wanted something a little bit different. And that seems like something, in my view, that is so transformative to society, that is so influential in composability, in this idea that we don't have to start from ground zero every single time we're trying to make something. We can have GCC, we can use the Linux kernel, and we can build on established coding languages that make it significantly easier, in my view, to do things. What do you think on that, Chives? Have you thought much on forking?
Oh, absolutely, John. Absolutely. And I'm glad that you brought that up. I think you're right that probably is something that maybe isn't super understood about open source projects. But because of the nature of GitHub and other online kind of file sharing platforms, you have this auditable history, right, of contributions and contributors so that you can trace back and look at these different initiatives, these different versions, you know, turn back the clock and review how things have gone in the past and how developments have transpired. And so, as you pointed out, let's say that there's some team which wants to go in a different direction, or there's a change which is made that, you know, with the best of intentions, but perhaps ends up not being completely symbiotic to the goals of that effort or of that community, then there's always the ability to go back to some earlier version and continue on your efforts from there. And it can be practically immediate too. I know it can be a tricky thing. You know, you're talking about essentially splitting then a community. Maybe there's some people who were to say, oh, well, this direction actually seemed like it could have been all right. Let's keep going for a little while. And you have others who say, we need to go back to that forking point and forge a new path because this is not going to work out. And so maybe you have a splintering, but what has that created? It's, you have not only a continued focus on transparency and on community between these two smaller groups, but you have a competition between them, a drive between each of them to solve the problem better than the other. And I'm sure if all the individuals in both those communities are driven and whatever their shared goal originally was, who's to say that they won't later end up recoalescing around whatever the better idea ended up being. You know, there's this continued, you know, growth, this flaring up. Maybe there's flaring out, but then there is rebirth. It's a phoenix of building, I think.
Yeah, it's a phoenix of building. And I'll say that, let me know what you think. It's something that happens as the projects grow into something much larger. They start as this passionate core community. And in the context of that event, it was at the point where it went from being thousands of people that understand and work on this to being arguably hundreds of thousands, if not more, that understand and work. And it expands and it's abundant. It is there's no limit to the potential here, is what I'm trying to say. Do you see, I mean, what do you think on that? Because these are, again, expansive, unlimited, and abundant communities emerging around their own objectives, their own principles, and crucially, their own set of standards that attract new individuals to that movement. No one's forcing anybody to work on these forks, so to speak, unless it's like their full-time job. But for the vast majority of contributors to the vast majority of open source projects, it's free time. And the question I have is your thoughts on that and your thoughts on sustaining all this so that you don't have to worry about the reliability of the Lemmy open source development statuses.
Yeah, well, that's where you start to cross into, I think, a much more nuanced and perhaps difficult conversation when we start thinking about sustainability and how these things actually develop. Because I guess there's multiple parts to this. First, I would say that one of the advantages of the centralized, you know, top-down leadership, distributed labor model is that you can pretty much have a timeline and you can ensure through, you know, either bonuses, I guess, with the carrot or, you know, withholding pay or threatening firings with the stick. You know, you can ensure that your project is going to move forward on some kind of time frame. And this becomes a lot more difficult, I think, when you're talking about distributed growth, these online communities that are predominantly, as you said, contributing out of their self-interest, their passion, their volunteerism. You know, it becomes a lot more difficult to specifically expect any kind of advancement on any kind of time frame because people's personal situations change. It may be that where today, you know, contributor Jeff has 10 hours a week to put into something that he's really familiar with, an expert in, and, you know, that contribution is well appreciated by the community. You know, a health emergency happens, some kind of weather emergency happens, certainly a lot of that going on at the moment. And all of a sudden, the ability of that time to contribute diminishes. And so then we get into, well, how do we counteract that? And I think we've touched on it a bit so far in this episode already. It has to do, I think, with the supporting individual contributors. You know, if there's some, you know, if Jeff in this example does this incredible job whenever they're able to do it, and if providing a monetary benefit to them would free up their time again to continue contributing, and a community, or more specifically, individual members of that community perceive that it would be well worth their contribution to ensure that Jeff is able to contribute. And when I say, you know, those community members' contribution, I mean a monetary one. Then you're starting to build something that's a bit more resilient. And that's something that exists all over the internet these days. I mean, massive companies like Patreon kind of cropped up visualizing this space that they could step into and operate as a organizer, you know, a distributor, you know, et cetera, for creators. Then you saw companies like Google, like YouTube partnerships, Amazon with Twitch, you know, they started to get into the game as well. And we see with crypto that there's really not even a need necessarily to involve all these other third-party corporations when you could just list a public address if you wanted to, or on GitHub with GitHub sponsorships. You know, that has a lower fee, more transparency, as compared to some of these other for-profit platforms. So all this to say, John, I think that there is a lot of fragility compared to the traditional top-down organizational system because people don't have their finances connected. And so when I say fragility, I'm referring again to this idea of metered, consistent progress. But that being said, if you have a robust enough community and people are interested to ensure its propagation and growth, then you can control for that. But it's, again, it's the decision of the individuals within that community. You know, it's not like, John GitHub can go up and say, all right, I need users of this site to start donating to these couple of people because they're running everything and they're making all the push suggestions and they are upgrading all of our UI, right? Because then you're just talking about a subscription again. And that's what we're trying to provide, the freedom for people to decide for themselves what these developments are worth. And so again, I think of this positive feedback loop where we're still early on this cycle, and many communities are early on this cycle. But broadly speaking, I think there are successful examples, of communities that engage with their user base and are able to step away from, kind of this more traditional top-down capitalist model, because they're engaging with their community and providing them with something that they find valuable. And it's not, you're not selling a product, right? You're not selling a service per se. It's really just whatever it is that these contributors are doing, there's a material value found in that amongst the donators or supporters or whatever they might be called. And I think it's hard to even find the right words for that without thinking of, I think of patrons, like that's what Patreon calls them, for example, but that's a proprietary term. We need new language because this kind of economic structure is itself somewhat new when you're talking about the incredible access to populations of millions spread across the entire globe enabled by these technologies.
Yeah, with you there, Chives. I will push back. There's a well-known influential software development book called The Mythical Man Month, and kind of the thesis of it is that software is kind of like cooking in that you can yell at the chef all you want, but the egg won't cook any faster. And so there's definitely a little bit of art to it, I would say. And so if you force people to rush software, I think it introduces, it's probably not the most ingenious idea personally. But I'm with you. I mean, there's sort of this whole implications of a new financial system and a new way of working. And the question for me becomes, do we want to leave that in the hands of a select few intermediaries that presently charge an extractive rent-seeking rate of 13% of your income?
Probably
should we put
not.
The entire economy on a system that gives them 87% of the value they create?
Yeah, it's this ridiculous toll booth, you've already bought your ticket to ride, and then they're going to, pay you to search to make sure that you have it. It's insane. There are better ways for these systems to operate. And when we think about better, I guess it depends on who you ask, right? Because I think a lot of the alternatives that we end up discussing on this show would not be viewed as better by established monoliths that are taking that 13%. But you ask any of the billions of people who make up some of that 13%, referring to their representation of the equity that is being sucked up in this way, then they probably would agree that they would like to see a more holistic and direct valuation of their time and their efforts, their investment, their labor. We could view that 13% as a massive inefficiency because it's not being properly distributed to the market which created it.
Oh yeah. With you there, Chives, and I really think that's our opportunity and something that is entirely within the realm of possibilities using blockchain.
Definitely, and utilizing a community of individuals around the world that are grasping with this inequality, grasping with this unfairness, with the monkey's paw deal that was taken. Yes, you can have immediate liquid access to this incredible capital market at any time that you would like, but you don't actually have control, and you have to surrender a huge portion of your equity, not just to go through an issuance process or to IPO or to trade day to day, but literally to participate at all. You need to surrender your ownership rights.
Oh, with you there on the sentiments, Chives, and completely agree that the community is really the core of all this. It doesn't work without the masses behind it.
Yeah, so then it gets back, I think, to community engagement and encouraging folks themselves to engage. And that's the beauty of these public communities that we can use, that the centralized platforms, you know, again, a monkey's paw, you know, oh, you want access for thousands and thousands of potentially people to not only be present in the community now, but be able to easily access it later. Well, you know, these central platforms are where everyone is. That's kind of how social media has, you know, bubbled over, and there's only these couple of surviving platforms. And of course, that's where people go because that's where all the people are. It makes sense when, you know, thinking about, well, if someone wants content or if someone wants an audience, they need to go to these spaces. And so I think that's why certainly in the short, the medium, depending on how everything goes, perhaps the long term, right? We're always going to be engaging in these communities as well. But importantly, encouraging folks to develop that curiosity to go to these more niche places, like not just our GitHub, but the collective effort of any open source project that they're interested in, and to roll their sleeves up and see if they can get involved, because that's what these projects are, is a group effort to develop something better.
Yes. Oh, so with you, Chives. And that's exactly what I was getting at with the Lemmy instance. It really, in my view, is an investment in this idea that we can truly own the content we produce and actually control the means of attention, something that presently is so challenging to access without paying these arbitrary rents to a select few companies. And it is, in my view, only by taking that control away, where they don't have the content, they don't have the influence, they don't have the news anymore. And instead, that is something that is owned by the community, that is hosted by the community, that is shared by the community, in the community, and for the community. That these new open platforms permit, they give us these systems where we don't need to spend 20 minutes trying to log in because it's open access. It is permissionless to join, and it's that same ethos that underlies the fundamental mechanisms that drive the systems. It's not one company making the algorithm. It's a collective brain. Recently, the SEC responded to our Edgar comment that we discussed in the original DTC episode referenced earlier. And that comment, the response, the final rule, it is stellar. It bases its information on extremely specific arguments from dozens of, it gives everybody's voice a chance to be heard. We were referenced 15 times because they take the feedback and they implement it into what they're working on. And of course, this is an example of a central regulatory body doing that, but it is just one key transitional period where the governance is not wholly defined by these monoliths. You can see very explicitly in so many lines of this final rule, places where the commission states they will change what they're doing because of these comments. And the idea that literally we have people that submitted comments to this, some from that show, that are people working from home, they're everyday mom and pop, Main Street Americans, and they just put in their opinions. And we have people that submitted comments on that rule that are monolithic organizational trade union consortiums that have immense influence. And what I cannot emphasize enough is that the final ruling in the adoption of EDGAR Next, in my view, very comprehensively valued, addressed, and adopted the thoughts of all commenters equally, because opportunity doesn't care how big your organization is. Your creativity isn't dependent on your market cap. And as we can see with this comment, the realities that you can bring to bear really sit entirely in the hands of each and every member of the community.
I think you're exactly right. And I think the beautiful thing, probably the comparison that we can draw here that's really crucial, at least in my eyes, is that A, that, you know, everyone has the ability to submit their thoughts. You know, that's one thing that I really appreciate about how the SEC, from a regulatory perspective, is constructed. And that's something, as we've been discussing, that is enabled by decentralized open source community hosting and development, such as through GitHub. And what that enables is for, you know, any individual to get involved to whatever degree that they would like, but crucially, they have that ability to get involved. It's not some, you know, private boardroom where only the people that are in the know would even have the ability to, I guess it's not even in the know, but you got to be on a list, right? You got to be able to get in. And that's just not what we are able to enjoy using these different resources. You know, in the case of the SEC, any individual that, you know, is engaged at all, directly or indirectly, with the U.S. markets has the ability to weigh in and potentially influence their thought process. If the argument is good, it's drawn, well, if the argument is good or the argument is bad, it is drawn into consideration for them to decide how to proceed. And that's the beauty of it. So together, right, together, market participants share their perspectives and the SEC moves forward. I think that's a great model, a model which, unfortunately, we don't have very much of in the regulatory reality of today, but that is what it is. I mean, that's the effective example here, and I think it's a really great one. And we have seen, I think, really terrifically over these last couple of years, retails, and when, you know, broadly speaking, just regular people, as you said, you know, mothers, fathers, other regular people all around the country have become so much more involved submitting SEC comments, or recently, you know, submitting things like the SEC petition, to review NSCC procedures. You compare these comment flows, which are all released publicly, to ones from 10 years ago to 20 years ago. It is completely different. Not only are there 10x or more comments being submitted, but those comments are coming from a much more diverse range of types of people, providing a much more diverse type of argument. I think that's incredibly helpful to create a system which is reflective of the needs of the many.
Do you think we could take him down, Chaz?
I think for me, what we're doing stands on its own feet. The goal is not necessarily to take them, you know, taking them down. That's something where that they're the ones who will help to decide that, I think, because providing people with an alternative and educating them about how the alternative works and how the legacy system works, you know, that will incite a huge amount of change on its own potentially. So I think it's a non-answer, but essentially, in my view, you know, taking them down is not the goal. Ensuring that we transition to a system that is actually coherent and provides good outcomes for its users is the goal. And, you know, if they want to get in the way of that, that's their choice.
I'm with you there, Chives. And like I said earlier, I mean, I can sympathize with where they're coming from. You had that second part interview recently on Access IM, and there was that idea that, you know, they just have an older framework. They haven't been forced to modernize. And I think anyone that's seen the success of Web3 so far it's quite a small jump in my view just to see, okay, well, wow, this decentralization thing actually works. You look at the SEC's whistleblower program. Wow, it's really effective. And just making sure that the bar to participate is as low as possible with the most protections available to those community members seems just like such a powerful concept to think that we could allow that to happen for community members like Overcat, community members like Silence, and the vast, expansive number of innovators across the globe to start these small businesses that have these ideas for a new reality, have visions for what can be, and take action on their ambition. It seems like just spreading out this opportunity would be something really stellar for the whole ecosystem.
Yeah, I could not agree more with the sentiment. You know, everyone benefits when everyone benefits.
Oh, but don't forget the middlemen, they don't benefit.
Well, they'll benefit a bit less if everyone is benefiting commiserately with them. But somehow I still sleep at night just fine. The history of industry is rife with discarded middlemen as more efficiencies have been discovered, developed, and integrated into the systems that we use every day. I don't think that's an important concern.
Gotcha. Let the market take care of it, huh?
That's it. We're building a better mousetrap, John.
Well, excited to see it progress and thankful for the Stellar community.
Well, certainly me too. And I'm excited for it to continue on growing. You know, it's a slow burn, I think, but this is a one-way street. I feel like the people that become engaged, they are curious, they keep learning, and at least for me, at least I only am more committed as I have traveled down the path. I only want to keep learning more and keep helping others learn more, and I believe that sentiment is shared by hundreds of people in not only our broader community but many thousands of people that we've not yet reached. And I imagine the latent sentiment for improvement is present still in millions more after that.
Oh, with you there, Chive. And it is so exciting, I think, to be able to uncover and share and nurture that latent sentiment that really is so powerful, because there really are just so many more of us than there are of them. And if only we could fuel that ambition with the education, the resources, and the tooling, and hopefully we can really make something special.
I think so. I mean, it's a great fun in its own special way to be doing it, and so we'll keep doing it. And I love the conversation today, John. I love your energy, your passion as always. diving into this subject and other subjects. So thank you. I was able to just sit back and enjoy, what you brought to the table here, what you bring every day. So thank you for that. And I know our listeners appreciate it too.
Of course, Chives.
Well, what do you think? Is there anything else that you wanted to cover? Or I also want to mention, for those listening live today, if you wanted to pop up and bring anything up, you're more than welcome.
Yes. I think that we're really focusing on trying to make that progress. And for me, it seems like the decentralization front is the key there. And so, I know we're working on making everything better. Everyone's going as fast as they can. And, I wholeheartedly believe that it's worth this investment, this startup effort, and this initial hurdle to deploy on these decentralized systems, which in some instances might not be up to par with standards, but it's sort of like being the first person to use email. It might not work as well as letter mail at the start, but if you can buy those early domain names, it's something that in my eyes is, when I first saw the crypto markets in 2017, I saw firsthand what I am sure felt like the 99.com bubble, which took years and years to occur. I am almost certain, talking to a large number of investors, that is what the .com bubble felt like in a very condensed period of time. It was 8 months for what was 8 years. And to think that we have this technology so readily available at our fingertips, and I mean at our fingertips, because everything, the ethos, the underlying sentiments, and the core of Web3 is all about this sharing, gifting, and communal environment. If we can just take that to the next stage where it becomes sustainable, not only on a personal enjoyment level, but also on a, roof above my head level, it just seems like a better way to function and a way to give the power back to the people in a way that protects the integrity that underlies so foundationally the American democracy.
Well, certainly, it's an incredible transition that is being attempted here by individuals, I think, today, some communities today, but towards this community model, this supportive model, where platforms are not as necessary, where you can create your own platform and be supported by the community of individuals that view, you or whatever you're doing as valuable to them, valuable enough to actually contribute funds towards. And that's, again, a completely different thing than having an account on some website, and, that website being able to pay out through ad revenue towards, the individual. Or, I think you brought up a while ago, right? Like, sponsorship deals and, these sorts of things with companies. I mean, that's a little more direct. I mean, the person is acting as their own agent, but still it's this outside company, which is capitalizing on the data and the access created through that platform. There's a still more decentralized and egalitarian, and honest method of distributing benefits, distributing support that, that we're marching towards, I think, as a society, quietly in the background, because this is not necessarily at the forefront of anyone's mind, but crucially, the technology exists and people are embracing it, bit by bit, in order to have a more salient and resilient relationship with whatever it is that they're engaging with day to day, as a developer, as a contributor, as a creator, et cetera.
Yeah. Love the sentiments there, Chives. And Completely with you. I think YouTube provides a pretty interesting example because, firstly, it was an extremely early platform, and secondly, video, voice, things like that are, in my, you know, I'll put it this way, it's easier to build a fan base, so to speak, in the context of supporting people when you use video than it is when you're just writing. That's my opinion. I think you get a little bit more emotion. I think, you know, a lot of people, emotion is a big part of their monetary choices personally. And so you kind of evoke that a little bit better instead of black and white text. And to see some of the largest users of that platform today, and I would like to really single out Mr. Beast as an example. I've been following him ever since he posted up that live stream where he counted to, 100,000 over the course of 3 days without stopping. I mean, that was unbelievable. And to me, that is the pinnacle of permissionless innovation. Like, this guy just sat in his room and counted on Twitch and recorded it. And that was really the bootstraps of his career that he'd been working so long on and to trying to make it a success for quite a number of years before that. But it was that moment where, you know, nobody told him to count to 100,000. Nobody told him to live stream it, and nobody told him to upload the whole thing on YouTube and actually break their compression algorithms because the video was too long. And yet this is something that they can do because of this infrastructure, because of this technology, because of the web. And to think that there are these select few intermediaries that are based on this underlying decentralized, permissionless, and empowering democratic technology we call the internet. They have construed it, contorted it, and through their own malfeasance, put it into this gate, at least in the Wall Street instance, where, you know, you just don't have a level playing field between everyone. You can, at any point in time, in the chat, in the nest, we have a comment from Bob talking about how your account might be shadow banned. And that's something that you have no control of. You don't know. I've seen so many creators that happens to them. And I just don't feel like that is a way to efficiently organize creativity, innovation, and people. And to think that we have a real shot at changing that, that's what I'm here to convince you of, because I see so clearly this reality. We are dealing with a game of capital allocation. It is the human capital to build these things. It is the social capital to share them, and it is the investment capital to prosper in innovative fronts that so flawlessly conform to the web, which are presently not in the hands of you and I. But the promise of these immutable blockchains is that it really does become something everyone owns, no one can corrupt, and everyone controls in a way that society has not seen before. And as the first Donna, Wideera seems to be at the forefront on that side.
We're absolutely taking every step that is feasible, I think, in measured consideration with our community, to push forward towards that kind of realization. And it's an incredible anecdote there, John. I mean, I've heard of Mr. Beast. I've never heard of his counting stunt. And I'll tell you, I wouldn't support that myself. But I can definitely appreciate that there's probably a ton of people out there that would chuckle and be interested in the attempt and want to check it out and to send some money his way. But you mentioned it was done on Twitch, and here's the thing, right? So those Twitch bits, those Twitch subscriptions, you know, these things, I think about 50 or 60% of those go to the creator, fine. But the rest of that is funneled into Amazon's pocket. And is that really, as you said, is that really how we want to be distributing creativity and the rewards of that creativity? I don't think so. Ideally, we'd be able to have a more direct relationship between, you know, if we call count into 100,000 live art,
But, you know, I think anything can be art. Anything can be art. So he's an artist, right? And we want to be able to connect directly people that are artists and people that are supporting it. And in that kind of sense, you know, the same thing for any kind of contribution that you're making to a broader code base to solve some more sophisticated problem alongside other members of your community for a shared self-interest or, you know, ethical goal or whatever that you might have, a disruptive goal. You know, again, like there needs to be a direct connection between these people that are doing something and those that want to see them do it. And it's, I think it's a very uphill battle we're talking about here because again, the trick of these platforms, the centralized platforms is that, well, everyone's on them, you know, because crypto was around, it sounds like when, this counting stunt happened, and maybe some donations made their way through that. Who knows? But I, you know, without doing any research, I bet the majority didn't, but of course, who knows if you could reach such notoriety if you did not first embrace the centralized platform to engage with an audience. And I think that's the real trick of it, you know, slowly acclimating society and people to be able to join in and to view, you know, engage with creators on a level-to-level basis without needing this gigantic intermediary and data broker in order to make it happen. So I think that I don't have an answer for how that transition will work, but certainly where we are now and where we can go in the future, I think those two images are clear, like you said.
Yeah, I'm with you there, Chives. The algorithm for attention and such is quite a nuance. It's hard, and it's certainly not right. I remember in the Origins episode, I'm sorry, the interview, the full in, I think it was, yeah, it was the full interview, in 16. You asked me at the end how people could learn more, and I gave them the I knew secrets, which, I'm in the process of migrating that into an open source website. It's just like a lot of work and such, but it's on my task list. You can actually see my present task. If you go to my GitHub profile and you go to projects, on the top bar, you can see my agenda and you can actually like visually see what I'm working on, what I've done. Just trying to make it transparent, kind of like the regulatory agenda for the chairs of the commission and such. It just seems like a good way to track that. You know, it's very basic, like one line describing it and maybe a little bit of context that I personally need to refer to. So by all means, you know, there's more efficient ways to do I mean, it was 7 years ago, and certainly the notoriety and the success came not from any kind of monetary donations, but rather the millions and millions of views that it garnered in a very short period of time. And so in that episode, when you mentioned that, I'm going to stop looking at the screen. I've got too many things up. In that episode, I told you about that website, and that website at the time, and I think still it just redirects to Amazon. And I've talked to PB on this, in regards to, I offered months ago to record an audiobook for him for free and haven't really had a definitive yes. No, we've had other conversations since then, but nothing on that particular item. And to think what is possible if this information, The challenge is for me with education in particular and like financial education very explicitly is that again you need money to make money, and that just promotes a plutocracy, and that's not a good thing. So if that particular aspect of it can be free, and who's to say others, I don't know, but if that particular aspect of nonfiction financial education is, you know, free people to learn, you know, open source, everyone can build the best guide to, I mean, cause there's not a good class on most high schools. You don't go through a finance class in most curriculums, and people start off life knowing absolutely nothing on how to function in a capitalist society, how to allocate their own money. And that's just particularly unacceptable and ridiculous. And that's one of the, I mean, that's like the main reason I wrote the book is cause no one talked about it. But that link it went straight to Amazon, and you said in that podcast, oh, let's use that link. Why give the money to Bezos or something along those lines? And I agreed with you because it's not right. But for a little bit more context and to expand on that in the context of this decentralization system, when I published that book, it was using a company called CreateSpace. And CreateSpace was really the pioneer, by my understanding, of print-on-demand, which is where they don't have a whole stack of pre-printed books. They just, you know, you order on Amazon, they have a machine, the machine prints the whole book, it binds it, it cuts, you know, it's actually pretty cool. Like, I've seen a YouTube video where it's like the machine that they have is awesome. It's a pretty incredible piece of engineering. And it just makes a book out of thin air. You put all the paper in and you print it and such and such. And so Amazon was using them as sort of the back end for KDP, by my understanding, which is their platform where anybody with an Amazon account can go in, give them their tax info, and you can publish a book. I saw this in high school and I said, this is the way to write a book. And so I opened up a Google Doc and I wrote for 9 months, and then I exported it to Word, and I had a school laptop subscription, and I was able to do the formatting necessary to put it in print, and you know, got it edited and did the title design and took the picture for that and did the digital art and such for the covers. And so I go through their central system. They have me put up the manuscript. Okay, here's the PDF. I upload the art. Okay, here are the covers. And I hit publish. And about a week goes by where it's in the review stage. And I'm like, okay, sure. They review it. They accept it. I email them. I'm like, hey, I've got this deadline, this personal goal of mine to have it published on the 28th, 29th. I wanted it to be published on the 29th. It got published on the 28th, a day early. So that was like, awesome. Great. So exciting. Made my goal that I had set about a year before to write a book, give or take. And after that, in about March, I wanted to publish something that I saw that didn't really exist in the world. It was a daily journal. And you can still see this on my Amazon author page. It's a 400 page. So there's two pages for each day, and it's just one page is blank and the other page is a schedule. And I used this for 3 years to track, you know, to schedule my days and to reflect at the end of the day. You know, the whole idea is reflecting, because there's a lot of evidence that shows that when you take time on a regular basis to reflect on the events in your life, it's materially beneficial to your mental health, your productivity, and your overall well-being. And so I did this for years. And what was interesting is that when I decided to just, you know, there was nothing like it in the sense that every journal you bought, it was like for a couple of months on the high end, and you didn't have like the space to put your goals on one side of the page and such. And so my idea that I made was, okay, I'm just going to formalize this into a book and I'm just going to put it on the same publishing thing, so that I can get a physical copy, so I can, you know, write it down. Back then, that's how I did it. And I had to resubmit that. And I wrote a little bit of an intro to it. I did a whole cover design and such. And I had to resubmit over and over, 3 times by my memory, that book to the review staff and argue for why it should be allowed to be published. It was something that needed to happen. And to think that if your views don't particularly align with the Amazon review staff on any day of the week, or if your perspective is too much for their central organization, and particularly in the context of formatting, it took me weeks to get everything formatted the way that you expect a book to be formatted, to get the title digital file to match their exact specifications and everything that you would expect a publishing house to do. Obviously, you don't get that when you write your own book. And to think later down the line, I recorded an audiobook that year and uploaded it to YouTube to host on a proprietary unlisted basis, whereby I would sell access to it on a website and give people the unlisted links. And, you know, you have a member portal and all the things you expect with, you know, education that you pay money for and such. And I took those recordings and I tried to put them on Audible. And you can see I have a repo on GitHub called ACX Audio. I spent a whole day trying to get these things formatted to satisfy their standards. It was a good 14 hours that I spent reviewing the standards, going through the process to edit each and every file, adding them into their naming scheme system and uploading them to the Amazon site. And after at least four email chains going back and forth with their support, they still won't let me publish it because somewhere in these, I think it's 12 or 13 hours, if memory serves, somewhere in this 13 hours of audio, there's a place where the audio dips below minus 60 dB, and I have no goddamn clue where that is. And they won't publish it until I fix it. And they won't tell me which file it is, even though I upload each file individually. To think that you can't really be creative without the requisite financial resources, time, or energy necessary to comply with these arbitrary centralized systems solely by the fact of your situational reality and decision on what to prioritize baffles me. And to think of a future where creativity is not limited to the select few individuals that land a book deal, but is instead open and accessible to anyone without the worry. You know, I was in high school. I was able to dedicate every minute of my life to this because I had 4 hours on a weekday and 28 hours on a weekend to put into this. And of course, on top of that, I would just do like every spare moment I had at school, every single lunch for the entire year I was writing. And to think that the bar today for publishing a major piece of work, because I think books are really the only way to actually, you know, have a real thesis and in an entirely contextual way, comprehend to somebody exactly what you mean without citing a lot of sources that are requisite for a shortened online summary or blog post and such. To enable someone to really present that story, especially in the nonfiction space, it is only available to a select few that can land through their own political connections a publishing deal at a major, you know, and so I appreciate greatly what Amazon did in lowering that bar to publishing. And ever since day one, they had pushback on the high royalties that they charge. There's the print cost they deduct, and then it's a 60-40 split in favor of I think it's of Amazon. I think they get the 60. I forget. I have to go to a bank account now, and that segregated bank account, I donate all the funds at the end of the year to a nonprofit called JA Worldwide. And I think that we have the opportunity to, when I published the book, after all that work, one of my close friends who actually is on my YouTube as someone that reviewed the book, you know, he and his dad, who was very influential and was the CFO that I, the, sorry, the, I, you know, the person that does the stock list for Duke and such, you know, they asked me, you know, if it was worth it, if I had, and this is a quote, made more than minimum wage. And of course, the answer is no. It sold like a couple $100 in the, and it's had more sales in the first month than since. With the exception of me buying my own copies, which is something that Amazon explicitly promotes. They say, buy author copies, promote your book. They also say, buy advertisements, which I did. I followed their instructions. I bought advertisements on Amazon. And it's just this extractive process where you're literally like this is something that happens every day in open source. You are paying money to do work. And, you know, it shouldn't be like that. There should be a way where you can believe in good faith that doing good work will receive just compensation without the political directorates requisite in central organizations. Does that make sense, Chives?
100%. I mean, it's an incredible process that you went through, and I applaud you for it. You know, a lot of folks don't have the discipline or gumption to see through a vision like that, or at least, actually, I should say, a lot of folks also just don't have the time. Not to disparage the discipline and gumption of regular folks. But all this to be said, even if it was the 40 that Amazon took, that's a lot. That's a lot. And while I can appreciate, as can you, that in the early, you know, in the late 90s and the early 2000s, where perhaps it would have been much more difficult to self-publish, to organize, and to reach an audience, the fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, right, that the landscape has changed. And it's not appropriate any longer for companies to expect such a massive lion's share of the efforts of, you know, an unrelated individual, just for the good graces of their, you know, sharing their platform and their access. I think that, you know, in the market, there needs to be more alternative competition. And I'm sure that there has been. Like, I wonder if those rates are true today as they were then. I wonder if that's still the same thing. We'd have to look into it. But point being, right, it's far too much. 40 is too much. 30 is too much. 20 is too much. We want to connect creators with an audience, with their audience directly. And I think that's what's enabled by not only, you know, blockchain distributed consensus technology with peer-to-peer settlement, but broadly speaking, you know, not just with services or products, but with ideas. And that's where, you know, open source community development provides a meaningful alternative for progress.
With you there, Chives, and Stellar Sentiments.
So I think we covered a lot of grounds here today, John. As always. And hopefully
it was enough. It was enough to drink all my water.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I think your cup is bigger than mine, but mine's a solid, probably about 30 ounces.
Oh, man, I went through three. I think it was a gallon.
Well, I'm sure then you've got other appointments. And I know that a while back I had solicited, you know, for any live listeners if they wanted to stop up, but none raised their hand. That's fine. Of course, anyone that is listening now or later, you can always reach us on any of the social medias. If you stop by ydrs.org, you'll find connections, emails, the ability to reach out. And of course, stop by the GitHub if you want to just dive right in. That's what this conversation was all about, of course, is, you know, encouraging that kind of independent action and that kind of independent curiosity and independent drive, as much as we can. Cause I think all of us are being affected, by this capitalist financial framework, and all of us have the ability to help to change it. So, you know, with that, I think any closing thoughts, John, or shall we wrap it up? And thanks again so much for the conversation.
Yeah, just one thing that came up with Bob, having checked the Discord chat just now. I forgot to about, but so yeah, I stopped doing the physical journals. And the point that kind of made me think about this was Bob said, charge 0% and let them take 40% of 0%. And, I'm kind of rebelling against them a little bit because actually the print costs went up last year and the journal I was talking about, since it's like 4 pages, I'm sorry. Yeah. It's literally like probably, I've got a ruler right here. It's a little over 2 inches thick of just paper. The print costs on it actually now cost more than the list price. And for one reason or another, they don't force the list price up. They tell you like a million times that you have to increase the price if you want royalties. So they are actually theoretically selling the journal today at a loss, but I've gone away from that because of the sentiments of monopolies and also the sentiments of the environment that have become so much more clear to me over the last few years that are certainly worth fighting for. And so I do now the Daily Journal on a private GitHub repo that I'll make public when I die. And I've tried to move most of the reflections that are not innately private onto the Free Markets blog, which is also on GitHub.
Beautiful. A great way to maintain a coherent connection to these decentralized values and transparency values.
Yeah. Also, I couldn't afford the reason I didn't buy another journal, frankly, I mean, there was the environmental stuff, but dude, it was like, I don't want to spend another $20 or so on this. I would rather put it in the stock market.
Well, yeah, good to be honest about one's personal finances. I think that's a whole other important skill set that, that maybe we'll dive into another time. All right. Well, thanks. Thanks, John. And thanks, Bob, for chiming in text on the Discord. That's, of course, always an option for folks as well if they want to participate live. And all right. Well, again, we'll look forward to some great conversations through the rest of this month. Everyone stay safe out there. Have a great rest of the week. John, be well, and we'll talk to y'all later.